Hey, Risto here at George Mason University. I will cut to the chase. We published a book, and by we, I mean Aaron Centeio from the University of Hawaii. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, Risto.
And Tom Quarmby from Leeds Beckett University from the UK. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Risto.
And the title of our book is Before and After School Physical Activity Programs, Frameworks, Critical Issues, and Underserved Populations. This book is available now through Routledge, and I've pasted the link to the book. You can get it through an ebook or the hardcover. It's available right now. It just got published in the very beginning of 2021. So let's start off with an interesting question to Tom. I want to know why your book was in the trash can before you even got to read it.
I think, to be honest, I think the postman tried to deliver the book, and for whatever reason, national lockdown permitting, we weren't in at the time. And so what he decided to do, or I think what I'm presuming what he decided to do, was he left it in a safe place and he dumped it in our green recycling bin. And in our green recycling bin is basically just a load of brown cardboard boxes, and the book came in brown cardboard packaging, so just like everything else. And I think I was very fortunate that I got an alert on our security camera to notify me that the postman had been down the drive and was putting stuff in the bin. And when I got back, I quickly grabbed it out, because that afternoon was bin collection day, so it had gone if I hadn't got there in time.
It just astounds me that that is the safe place to store things in this person's mind, which I saw that on Twitter, and I literally laughed out loud. I thought it was hilarious that somebody goes in and goes, hey, I think they're going to look for this in the trash can, instead of like hiding it behind a bush or something like that. Or under the welcome
mat. The only thing I can think of is that he was worried about wet weather.
Yeah. Well, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. And we're very happy that you got your copies. And we have a ton of different authors on this book. So it's been cool to see them post or just send a nice email to us saying that they finally got their copies. And we just wanted to do this kind of podcast to get the three of us together to discuss the book, kind of explain what it's about, highlight a couple chapters. But I guess first we want to clarify in the book what we talk about, or what we define as before and after school physical activity programs, and how they're different from PE. Because Tom, Aaron, and I both, or all of us, have done research in schools, and we've started to do some more after school research recently. And so I guess the bare bones definition of after school or before and after school, it's basically any time that's outside of the normal school hours, but still the parents haven't picked up their kids. So in a before school program, it's after they drop them off and the parents go to work, they're at school, but it's not during regular school hours. Or after school programs, obviously before the parents are able to pick them up. And the biggest difference that we've seen here is time. Like in after school programs, we have so much more time, and we have less of these rigid regulations in before and after school programs. You know, in a school where you might have standards, or you might have very specific minute requirements, you know, the REACH program that we highlight in the book that I wrote about, you know, we have 2.5 hours, 2 hours, 2 days a week with the students. So I found that it's time to build relationships, and it's so much easier to do that. And I think, you know, the recent research, Carla Luguetti talks about activist approach, you know, Michael Hempel talks about restorative approaches. I just think that in after school programs, you just have so much more time to actually implement those. So our focus in the book is about physical activity programs, not necessarily PE, but I would venture to guess that if you walked into some of these after school programs that we highlight in the second theme, you would think that it might be physical education. But We use some other language in here too, and we want to kind of clarify that as well. So Tom, can you explain, one of the sections is focused on socially vulnerable or underprivileged or underserved students, and we kind of go through those. So you wrote that section on how to define the differences between those. So can you kind of explain the differences between those terms and what we used?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, you know, we've framed the book with the term underserved, which stems from Hellison's work with children and young people who live in sort of socially stigmatized or minority communities and who face a range of issues such as, you know, poverty or a high prevalence of gangs and crime. But there's a range of terms that have been used previously across the sort of broad spectrum of PE and youth sport to describe similar populations. So Rachel Sanford, for instance, has used the term disaffected youth. Fred Coulter has used the term youth at risk. And more recently, you know, Carla Luguetti and Kim Oliver have coined the term youth from socially vulnerable backgrounds, because this term highlights the social conditions in which children and young people live and avoids the sort of blame game, and that blame being positioned at the at young people's feet. So importantly, in the book, the chapter authors draw on sort of the full range of these terms, but they do so to describe youth who have predominantly fewer opportunities than their peers and who now or in the past have experienced some form of inequality or injustice.
Yeah. And I think that those terms are really important to discuss. And I love the fact that we had this long discussion exactly about the blame, right? That it's not termed to specifically the youth. So I think maybe it's good that I can kind of give like an overview to this edited book. I think one of the bonuses that comes out of this is that there's so many different worldviews. We have scholars from all around the globe talking about different angles. It's not specifically US focused. And I think in the very beginning, when Aaron and I first started talking about this book, we did have a very US specific focus, and we reached out to Tom to come up and kind of globalize us a little bit and give a UK view. And we brought in some authors from Australia, New Zealand. So the book is basically broken down in three themes. The first one is about frameworks. So Aaron wrote about CSPAP and the whole school, whole community, whole child model. Other frameworks that we highlight in this area, restorative practices, positive youth development through sport, social emotional learning. And then Fiona Chambers talks about a program that they did at the PEET level about having teacher education students, undergraduate students, work out of school time with other college students. The second theme is about methods of current programming. And basically this is highlighting successful programs that researchers have conducted research with. So I wrote in with Kelly Johnston and Ray Frederick about our REACH program. Carrie Saffron talked about innovative qualitative methods. She also has a really interesting blog on playing with research in qualitative research that's up on our HPE website. Tom, you have a chapter in Care Experienced Youth. There's a chapter about conflict-affected regions, LGBTQ. Dylan Landy wrote a chapter on that, and then urban schools. And then the third theme is about critical issues. So we talk about informal sport. Justin O'Connor comes from that line of thinking from Australia, preparing adult learners to work in these after-school programs. Senlin Chen wrote a chapter about how to fund after-school programs. And Lee Spurka talked about outsourcing. And then the last chapter is about student voice. So I think the book's biggest selling point is that there's such a wide overview of what's going on in this space. And it comes from, you know, scholars who are really doing the work. And we're super happy to have so many different contributors to the book. But let me ask you, Aaron, if you can kind of share a little bit more about the role you think before and after school physical activity programs play in lifelong physical activity?
Yeah, of course, Risto. So obviously we know that, you know, youth across the world are becoming less active more and more. And this is especially evident right now as we're still, you know, dealing with a pandemic, and some of us are coming off of being in lockdown. Some of us, as we're listening to this, are still in lockdown. And so, you know, physical activity among our youth is problematic. And so before and after school programs, if we think about kind of a CISPAP or a whole school model, have a unique way to be able to contribute to this. So, you know, you obviously, I'm a big CISPAP fan. In my work, I do a lot around integrating physical activity before, during, and after school programming. And as you mentioned before, like PE, sometimes when we think about physical activity within physical education, you know, there's a lot of other things that go on in physical education. And the one unique thing about before and after school programs is that you don't have kind of these restrictions that we think about within physical education. So you're not, you don't have to abide by standards. You don't have limited time. And so there's really this opportunity for before and after school programs to contribute. Now, that's not saying that that's the only thing that they should contribute to, right? Like, as you stated, sometimes you have a lot more time to be able to work with, and you can kind of build physical activity uniquely and within certain contexts in different ways. But allowing kids these free opportunities to be physically active is really important right now. And I see before and after school programs kind of playing a big role in that. You know, the other thing is that you're just really able to like make it relevant to youth because you don't have these restrictions. So I'm going to go back to an old reference of the Field of Dreams. You know, they, in that movie, they say, if you build it, they will come. And I really think that that is the case for before and after school programs. I think one of the things that we struggle with is getting kids there, getting youth there and present. And so as interventionists, as programmatic people that are running after before and after school programs, we really need to make it relevant to youth because we want them to come, and it's not something that they have to attend, right? So making sure that we're making it relevant within that context, I think, is really important to help kind of contribute to that overall goal of increasing physical activity.
Yeah, and I think one of the big things there is the access and transportation. I never realized how big of a hurdle transportation is in getting physical activity programs or after school programs running. And I think, you know, as much as we can, we should run the programs on school property. So there's no transportation issue there. But then it's also, if you are taking a bus, so if you're getting a school bus to school, then the whole school district needs to adjust and have early and late scheduled buses. So it doubles the cost of transportation, really, because people who aren't going to the after-school program have to get on the bus at 2:30, 3 o'clock, and those students at, you know, 5, 6 o'clock when they're going home, you're assuming that that parent has that transportation to come pick them up. And I just never realized how big of a struggle that is. And I know there's a great wrestling program called Beat the Streets that's in a bunch of different communities, started in New York City, and they would provide a one-way metro card to get back home. So anybody that comes in, they always paid for that ride home. And it's just like, if you think about that times hundreds of kids every day, that's a huge expense of just getting the transportation. So have you all seen any other barriers that you've seen in after school programs, Tom, in the maybe the UK context? Are there systematic barriers to getting to these programs for youth?
I think, to be honest, you know, transportation is a big one. I guess a lot of after-school programs in the UK are much more part of the school rather than provided for by external companies or external agencies. So it's more of an extension of the school day rather than a put on provision by a specific program or something, which is, I guess, where the differences in context mm-hmm. become apparent a little bit.
Yeah. What about in Hawaii? Because, I mean, one of the things that I feel like the European system has a little bit better is, especially in more like urban areas, you have a great system of transportation. You have public transportation. So if you're taking a bus or something, you're not relying on a school bus. You're just taking a normal bus to get to school. But what about in Hawaii? What are the barriers that you've seen to after school or before school programs?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, transportation is obviously an issue, but and that's for before school programs too, Risto. I think that, you know, getting kids there early is also, like, if you're going to run a before school program, like, you have to get kids there early, which mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily run on a bus schedule. But, like, here in Hawaii, I think, you know, transportation plays a role, but transportation to schooling is a little bit different here in Hawaii in general. Like, we don't have public school buses. City buses, if a kid needs to get to school, kind of serves that role. If you're going to in the public school system, it's like pretty much walkable for the most part. But that doesn't mean that students actually walk. And then, I mean, we have a huge privatized school system here in Hawaii. So a lot of kids are being bused across the island or, you know, Kamehameha, where a school where you have to have a Native Hawaiian blood, like that's really the only system that does bus to school. And they do have buses that will go kind of like the late early, as you're talking about. I think one of the other issues that I see, not just here in Hawaii, it does play a huge role here in Hawaii, is a space issue. And so if we're thinking about before and after school programs, like where do you host these programs? And I know that that's also a case, you know, in Michigan, where I was previously, like you compete with a lot of other different activities, such as, you know, sport programs, when you're thinking about, you know, if you don't look at those sport programs as a traditional, you know, after school program. And so, like, space is an issue. And I think that that's everywhere, not just here in Hawaii, but it's probably heightened, obviously, because, you know, we're on a rock. But
interesting. I never thought that Hawaii doesn't have school buses. I don't know why that's so surprising to me. But I think that there's so many different struggles here, but I think that there's been a lot of really good work done in this space. And, you know, we had several chapters in here that were just really, really good. But I'm going to force you to each pick one or two to kind of just highlight, not saying that they are better than the other ones in your section, but just to kind of highlight a couple chapters. So, Tom, let me start with you. Is there a chapter that you'd like to share or, you know, highlight, or that you feel like deserves extra recognition or just is more relevant?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, just to reiterate what you've said there, Risto, all of them are excellent chapters. But I think there were two that I was particularly fond of. So I'm going to be greedy and I'm going to highlight two very quickly. One of them was Justin O'Connor's chapter on informal sport. And the other was Lise Burke's chapter on sort of outsourcing it and thinking about the future of before and after school physical activity. So with Justin's chapter, he explores the changing role and the place of informal sport and looks at data on sporting trends to position this increasing influence of informal sport within young people's lives. And in doing so, he essentially argues that before and after school programs should not focus on getting young people ready, in inverted commas, for participation in games or sports, which, you know, that's usually done through the teaching of motor skills, often in isolation. But instead, he says what we should focus on is fostering positive social relations and helping young people to find their best way to participate. And that may be in informal sport. And if they do this as a consequence, then fitness, skill development, all of those things will eventually develop. as young people continue to participate. And I think that chapter really, really resonated with me. I think it's really current and contemporary and offered a lot of insights. And then
let me jump in real quick, when I read Justin's chapter, and he's had a couple different articles about this, I just find that it's so obvious, right, in formal sport, but it's not something that people have done research on really. And we don't really know what it looks like in different contexts, because Justin's really one of the main people who has been exploring the space. When I was introduced to his work, I just found it really fascinating. I asked one of my students who I'm working with, he's in a student teaching semester right now, and he has a little bit he's in a secondary school setting. He's having a hard time with their kind of motivation. They're not doing all these exciting things that he thought they were gonna do. So I suggested that he pull the class and ask them, what are their most meaningful experiences in physical activity? And he said, in PE. And I said, no, just leave it open. Just see what they come up with. Mm-hmm. And almost all of them that he's had to up until right now are out of school informal activities. It's meaningful experiences, having an awesome hike or going snowboarding or snorkeling or something like that, that are just not in PE. And I think it comes up with a problem there, because you have to figure out how to incorporate those things. But I think Justin's really onto something. I'm super happy that you highlighted that chapter, because I think the informal sport is where most of us are physically active as adults, going to the gym when they can, or going on a bicycle ride when we can, or seeing that you have an hour in your time in your day and you go out for a run, or planning a hike or something like that. And people who could join you, and people who don't. Or if something comes up in your day-to-day schedule that you can't participate, you know, it doesn't matter. You can do it the next day. You're not going to get penalized and not be able to play on Saturday because you didn't show up to practice on Thursday.
And I think anecdotally, informal sport, at least in England, it is growing in the before and after school space. But I think there's still probably a bit of a lag, in the sense that, you know, Richard Tinning talked about it years ago, about the disconnect between PE teacher and youth culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still very prevalent in the before and after school space, in the sense that, you know, in England, a lot of it is delivered by PE teachers who deliver in PE very traditional activities. And so, you know, a lot of these parkour, skateboarding, you know, some of these are beyond the lexicon of what PE teachers are used to. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't carry over into that space, but it is certainly gaining more prominence in the UK context, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about Lee Spurka's chapter?
So the second chapter that I wanted to highlight, Lee's chapter, it basically looks at the possible futures of what before and after school physical activity programs might look like or might be. So she describes one possible future whereby, and this is driven by an overcrowded curriculum and the low status of health and physical education. In this scenario, before and after school programs are delivered by external providers and they consume curricula HPE. So they basically take it over. The other possible future is where curricula HPE consumes after school programs due to the sort of overscheduling of children. And in such a scenario, sport and fitness are solely then delivered in curriculum time, which, you know, she makes the case that it takes away the E from PE, but that's one potential future. And what I really like about that chapter is that it just gets you to, it prompts you to think about what might be if we carry on in these trends with outsourcing, where we might get to and what we could do as educators, practitioners working in that area to work with those potential futures.
Yeah. Awesome. Aaron, What about a chapter or two from your section?
Yeah, Risto. So, you know, this is really hard for me. You know that I'm one that I don't like to make decisions. So for all of you that don't know me well, I hate making, like, put in a box to make decisions. So theme two really focuses on, like, before and after school programming in underserved communities. And this was kind of our practical theme where we got to see a lot of before and after school programs in practice. And so it was really hard to choose one or two. But I think the two that stuck out to me the most was Chapter 9 by Carrie Saffron, Getting Lost and Being Flexible and Using Innovative Methods in After-School Programs. And then Chapter 13 by Dylan Landy, which was Outside the Box, LGBTQ Inclusive PA Programs. And what I really like about these two chapters, and I would say that this can be seen in a lot of chapters in this theme, is this idea of student voice and how we really need to listen to students that are in our programs and allow those students to kind of drive what's going on in the program and be okay with, as program developers, as interventionists, as school personnel, be okay with students really organically developing what's happening in those programs. And, you know, they talk about just this importance of student voice and making sure that we're involving the youth. And I really think, you know, that this is important to keep in mind. We can't be planning programming and, you know, going and inserting it in isolation. Like, we really need to understand what the youth are thinking. And I think that that's what's going to lead to successful before and after school programs. And then also just the concept that, you know, obviously I'm a proponent of physical activity, but I think that it's important to keep in mind that there's so many benefits of before and after school programs that our students can take away. And although, you know, we have a focus of health and being lifelong learners, you know, kind of allowing the students to lead allows them to go in a direction that they need. And I think that that's, you know, really important.
Yeah. And those two chapters are also really well written. Like, they flow really easily and you kind of get caught up with them. So both great chapters to pick. I'll highlight one in that early section about the frameworks. And one of the reasons why I chose Using Restorative Practices in Out-of-School PA Programs by Michael Hemphill and Kevin Richards is that I've worked with Michael and Kevin on a project using restorative practices, and I see so much potential in this. And the chapter is really good because it outlines what they are, how to use them, what the process is, and, you know, Michael talks about and Kevin talk about the fact that, you know, these restorative practices have been around for ages specifically in, like, Indigenous cultures, the First Nation in Canada, Maori populations, Native Americans, and that restorative practices extend beyond the prison system of restorative justice. And I think that, again, it's... And Michael runs this program in North Carolina in a secondary school in, like, school time. So I know it can work in schools, but I think it's harder to do so in, like, doing these awareness circles and restorative circles in a 30-minute a day PE program. But I think in after-school programs, these can really thrive. And, you know, Michael has, and he presents here as well, this idea of restorative youth sports, which I think can work really, really well in sports programs in, you know, whatever level it is, if it's at the university level or if it's at a rec league level. I think these restorative practices can be really seamlessly integrated. And for those of you who know what teaching personal and social responsibility, TPSR model is, it has a lot of overlap with that, and he's built it on top of work in TPSR to have the restorative youth sports model. So I just found it a really informative, easy chapter to get into. So that's why I picked that. Again, tons of other chapters in here that were all great. But let me ask you both, what are the next steps? Like, what are we, at the end, we in the conclusion section, we set up a bunch of questions that we want answered. But what are the things, and let me go to you, Tom, first. What do we need to know still in these after school or before and after school programs?
I think for me, and this echoes Erin's point that she raised a minute ago, you know, research in this area is relatively new in comparison to sort of mainstream physical education. And I think it's still a question of making sure that we continue to capture the experiences of underserved youth in these novel programs and consider what is important to them and what learning we can take from it to inform practice in other contexts. And I think that's what we do really well in this book is, as you said, Risto, we provide a range of different contexts from the US to the UK to Australia, New Zealand, etc. And I think moving forward, it's a case of how can we listen to young people? How can we take the learning from what they're saying and how can we inform practice in different contexts?
Mm-hmm. What about you, Erin? What are some things that you still think that we need to know?
So for me, it's about how we take all this great information and use it to scale up. So, you know, we see all these amazing examples of programs, but in reality, they're kind of in isolation or they're siloed. Like, we have really good success stories, right? But, you know, they're successful because they're in a specific situation. They're run by certain people that have a passion for what they do. And so how do we teach this on a larger scale to disseminate to the masses to actually make a difference for all youth or the youth that need it the most, right? Because what we know of programming is that the second that you try to scale something up, the more likely it is to fail, right? Because you're losing all of the concepts that are most valued, like student voice and making sure that programs are culturally competent and context specific. And along that same lines, you know, these programs tend to be pretty expensive. As you were saying, there's a lot of barriers that occur. So how do we take these things that we have learned and use them to provide these opportunities to more youth in more areas across the world, really?
Yeah. And I wish I would have shared my talking points with you because they were exactly the same. And I wish I would have gone before you because you made those points much more eloquently than I would have. I totally agree. I think scaling up is super difficult. And that's, you know, where internally dealing with that in Reach right now. We've had now 6 years of research in various contexts in New York and California and in a Peace Corps collaboration. And we're having a hard time figuring out how to actually implement the program when I'm not there or Ray's not there or Kelly's not there or, you know, I feel like, and then this is a, you know, issue with, I think, a lot of programs is you run it out of a university setting or you have pre-service teachers working in there. But then how would I run a program in Alaska? How would I run a program in Oklahoma? And how would, you know, Dylan run a program or, you know, Carrie run this program? They're so invested in these programs. And part of it is, look, you can go in and observe and you can do like a case study and document the progress of a successful program. But I still think that the scaling up is such a question because you need so much money to be able to do it. But then you also need to be able to train the teachers. And there's a chapter about that, of how to train adults to work in these after school programs. But how do you keep them accountable? How do you know that what's happening when you are not present? So I don't know. What do you think?
I think that goes back to what Tom was saying too about documenting like, we have to be better at documenting these success stories and really trying to get at, like, what makes them successful, and then using that information to then teach the next generation. And I don't know what that looks like, but I think that it's all intertwined, right? Like, it, the research has to inform what we're doing, and that's going to be a way to help disseminate. But it really is about teaching and getting the right people to run it. And it, I don't know, yeah. It's like an never-ending circle, right?
Yeah, and I think the one of the issues with getting competent adults in there, right? You have a really great student or a college student who's really passionate, wants to be a PE teacher. They're the best after school teacher that you've ever had. They work for 2 years and they come up to you and say, hey, I have a full-time teaching position I have to take that's, you know, in another state or 2-hour drive from here. I'm moving. And then you lose that person. And rightfully so, like, great. They were learning how to teach and they were a really good after school person, but you can't support a family only working 4 hours a week. So you have to pursue these other avenues. And I think that's the problem, is you have this constant revolving door of really qualified coaches and teachers in the after school space who are leaving. So I think, again, building inside your own community, inside that school, keeping those students in that program that are also teaching at the elementary school or middle school or high school right there. And they're just, instead of coaching, they're, you know, instead of coaching an interscholastic team in the US, they're working in an after school program. So any other?
Well, and I think that.
Go ahead, Erin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, like, you know, one of the things that Dylan talks about in his chapter is this, like, involvement of youth and really allowing youth to run it. And so if you are able to create a situation, and this is obviously probably more at the secondary level than it is at the elementary level, but if you create a situation where the students are really kind of running the program and the adult, and I say that in air quotes, present is more of a supervisor and not necessarily driving the program, then you can see those ideas and those concepts kind of be passed from generation of student leadership. But developing that takes time and a special person to be able to develop that culture, right? And so there is still that sense where you have to get that up and running, and then how do you have someone carry it over? So I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Just building on that, and I guess this is where, again, the context is different. You know, in the UK, a lot of our after-school provision is provided by outsourced external companies, and their role is to deliver physical activity, not necessarily to step back and be the facilitator, mm-hmm. Like you were saying, Erin. And so that, with it, poses additional problems and additional challenges to, well, if you've got something that's useful and working, how do we take the learning from it and scale it up and so on? It's really problematic if a lot of these programs are outsourced by companies who are profit orientated.
Yeah, I think it's hugely problematic for sure. And I think that these, you know, student design, student driven programs are really interesting. Mm-hmm. I just had Carla Luguetti and one of her co-participants on a podcast that's going to launch after this one about her work in with African Australian refugee students, and it started from a community based kind of kick around the ball program that has then scaled up because people in that community feel so strongly about helping people in their own community. And it's not externally, like, they don't have an external provider. It's built within the community. And I think that is a fascinating line of research for sure. And I think the other thing that I'm more, like, most interested in is, what's the role of informal sport in after school programs outside of Australia? Because we do have some data from Australia from Justin O'Connor and his colleagues, but We don't know a lot about that. And I think that there's, if you read the last chapter and read the conclusion, if you need ideas for future research, there's a ton in there. So any final thoughts or any other final things that you feel like we should be looking for going forward, or anything about the book, Tom?
The only other thing I would probably add is, and again, it's sort of aligning with the points that we've already raised, is, you know, how we probably need to know how well before and after school programs reinforce or challenge social justice issues that are evident. And I think that's a real strength of the book, is that there's a social justice thread that runs throughout it. But I think we still need more. We need to know more about how well they reinforce or even reproduce or do challenge those social justice issues.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Erin?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just going to agree with you, Tom. I think that, you know, we tried to make sure that as we were kind of lining up chapters, right, and authors, to make sure that was kind of a string throughout the book. But I think you're right in the sense that we don't really know. As you had stated earlier, there's not tons of research in this area. And so I think that is an important thing to keep in mind as we move forward.
Absolutely. Thanks, Erin. Thanks, Tom. I think this is a good spot to wrap it up. The book is available on the Routledge website. It's part of the Routledge Studies in Physical Education Youth Sports series. You can find it there as an ebook. I actually asked our university to get the ebook. They did that very, very quickly through the library. So all of our Mason students can just go on and right click, download that ebook. So there are a bunch of different avenues to get it. We also want to thank all of the chapter authors who contributed to the book. I think it's a great go-to spot for before and after school physical activity research. So thanks, Tom. Thanks, Erin. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.